It's Greg Gutfeld. Welcome to The One. A lot of people ask me, Greg, how did you become so successful? You are so smart and witty, as if that naturally happened. It did naturally happen. I was naturally good looking, but I wasn't always witty and well-spoken, and I had a lot of help. Much of the help came from one guy when I was over at Rodale Press, when I used to work at Men's Health. And that's my guest, the guy who helped me out. His name's Dennis Boyles. He's a journalist, an editor, a university lecturer, author, and editor of several books of poetry, travel history, criticism, humor, practical advice, essays. He also wrote for National Review Online, a lot of great columns there. His recent books include Superior Nebraska, which was a book about Midwestern political and social values. He also did a book, a really interesting book, on the Encyclopedia Britannica's 11th edition. As you can tell, Dennis Boyles has a keen eye for commercial success. He did a book on the Encyclopedia Britannica. He now lives in France, Dennis Boyles. Dennis, what are you doing right now?
I'm sitting here in this cold, cold pile in northern France. Freezing.
It's freezing. What are you working on now?
I'm kind of looking at a book on the what they call the Vendean Wars over here. It was sort of the first real genocide where the revolutionary government didn't like the peasants living out on the western edge of the country, and so they sent six columns of army troops marching parallel through the countryside with instructions to kill everybody they found, because these people wouldn't subscribe to the tenets of the revolution. They weren't actually, you know, anti-revolutionary. They weren't anti-monarchists or anything. They were they didn't like what the revolution wanted to do to the church. Mm-hmm. So it was a church-state issue.
So why does this topic interest you?
I think that there's a lot of sort of animosity about you know, this sort of around this topic of morality and, you know, right and wrong and all the rest of it. And I think that the big struggle culturally is to see who gets the right to determine how, you know, who has the power to tell other people how to live. Mm-hmm. And I think that that issue is a real crucible, I believe.
Do you think, you know, I want to talk about writing with you, but since you brought this up, do you think we're heading in a direction where these things might actually happen, or are they already happening?
Well, what things do you mean?
I think that the absence of dialogue, I hate that word, but the absence of dialogue, then yeah. All you have left is violence. And I mean, in the United States, we keep seeing these flare-ups between Antifa, not so much anymore since we forced them to take off their masks. But there seems to be – you notice how Antifa kind of – there's something Scott Adams pointed out, that once you got them to take off their masks, you don't see much of them anymore.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that requires courage, and I'm not sure that a big mob is, you know, the best vehicle for courageousness.
Yes.
I think we are kind of drifting that way. I mean, I think that in a way this is sort of – you know, what happened in Western France 200 years ago, 250 years ago, is sort of like what happened in Waco, Texas, what, mm-hmm. 25 years ago? I mean,
right.
There's a certain assumption that the state has the right to send in guns and shoot people if they don't believe the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's pretty dangerous. I mean, I think it was dangerous then, and I think it's dangerous now.
I can barely remember Waco, but there were accusations, if I remember, there were accusations of, like, child abuse, right? Wasn't that the reason why Janet Reno sent them there to begin with, because they felt it was a cult?
Well, that's what she said, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I'm not a conspiracy theorist or anything, but I don't know how much that was proved. I don't know whether or not that was actually ever settled fact.
Right.
But it certainly wasn't settled fact when she sent these people in and started shooting people. And yeah. I, you know, it was an accusation at the time, so I don't really know.
You know, I the reason why I wanted to talk to you is because not to talk about conspiracies, although I do enjoy them. You are like I said, you kind of, when I first met you, I would consider myself more or less raw material as a writer. I think I was a decent writer, but I wasn't I had more potential. And I thought you helped me a lot. And I always wanted to know, like, what when you are, you know, I consider you one of my favorite writers. Can you take, how do you take a bad writer or a raw writer and turn them into a good one? What do you see, you know, are the areas that you focus on to make somebody a stronger writer?
Well, it's all about voice. I mean, the strength of your writing, I think, has always been the fact that you have complete confidence in what you're saying. And the job of an editor working with you is to kind of get rid of the undergrowth, get rid of the stuff that confuses the clarity of your message. I mean, you know, you can write about very, very funny things, and the strength of your voice is the thing that makes it work. It's not never the jokes. It's always the delivery. So, I mean, it's really, with you, it's an easy thing to do, editing, because you just simply have to, like, knock out all the words that are in the way.
But that's what editing is. I realized when working with you is that your job is to knock out all the words that are in the way, and the writer tends to see every word as more important than it is.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. I remember a long time ago when I was a graduate student, I went to this poetry workshop thing, and the guy teaching it was this ancient old guy. He was very smart. Elliot Coleman was his name. And he said, here's what I want you to remember, that the poetry is not the words on the page. It's the words you don't put on the page. Mm. I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, if you read modern poetry, you probably agree that less words on the page, the better.
Yes.
But he was really on target with that. And I think it's a good way to work on poetry. It's also a great way to edit copy. I mean, just, you know, get the stuff that doesn't matter out of the way.
Yeah, and that this is the difficulty with working with somebody like you. If you, the writer, is sensitive or has a fragile ego. So if you're working with,
right.
I know writers that when they worked at different magazines that had to work with you that just hated you. And I always knew, but like, right. I was like, because you were just taking their words away from them. You were basically trying to get rid of the clay to find the sculpture, and they didn't. They just resisted it.
Yeah, I mean, I think you know, at that level, once you've actually figured out what your idea is, and the work at hand is to express the idea, you're essentially working in the field of mechanics. You know what I mean? It's like. Mm-hmm. It's like two guys getting mad at each other because they don't like the way their timing belts work or something. I mean, it's just strictly dealing with the machine.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't mean that, you know, you don't have regard for the design or the beauty of it or something else. It's just a matter of getting it to hum properly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, that's what an editor should do.
I already have an answer to this question, but what area of writing showcases the worst kind of writing?
Well, it varies, I think. I mean, I think at the moment, poetry, of course, mm-hmm. is way ahead of everything else. I mean, nobody can read that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that the coming attraction in bad writing mm-hmm. is in essaying.
Mm.
And I think essayists have really got their hands full because they're so full of the need to preach.
Right.
That they can't quite get clear on what the idea is.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's probably what it's going to be. I think that's going to be the next big mess, I suppose.
I think with essays, too, the goal is to announce what ideas can't be discussed. I think that's the new thing. It's that essays are now about essays or ideas that are considered unacceptable because of through that prism of identity politics. So a lot of the essays are just like why these things – you can't talk about these things anymore, or like why The Simpsons is racist. You know, it's just like it's now – they're attacking words and ideas rather than presenting them. I don't know. It makes sense or no?
Yeah.
Yeah,
no, it does. I mean, I think that essayists especially – and you really see this in editorial writers and newspapers – you see themselves in one of two ways. They're either liberty leading the people, you know, like in that famous painting and stuff.
Right.
And there they are. They're holding the flag, and mm-hmm. all those poor peasants are, like, following them because they're so godly.
Mm-hmm.
They're either, you know, that's the way they want to see themselves.
Yeah.
The other way they see themselves is sort of the anguished heroine of a Jane Austen novel, being appalled at the you know, the incivility of the common people that surround them. I think either way, you're looking at this sort of, you're looking at two sides of the elitist coin. Mm-hmm. You know, you're looking at people who think they're, you know, better than everybody else and should lead them, or you're looking at people who think they're better than everybody else and are appalled by them.
Right.
But I think that's kind of the trope of the moment anyway.
My nomination for the worst writing on the planet is in music journalism. I love, I buy about, I don't know, 10 records off iTunes like a month or whatever, and I read everything. And it is amazing how awful record reviews are, because it's all a lot of virtue signaling in the first paragraph. They're always like, it doesn't matter what record it is. It could be LCD Sound System, and they'll be, the first sentence will always be in Trump's America, or since Trump was elected. And then they go, right. they work their way, and like all the horrible, how life is horrible and we're heading towards the apocalypse, before they get to the album.
Yeah. Well, if you're writing about popular music, you got to work really hard to make it important.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So the best way to make it important is to equate it with the big evil,
yeah.
You know, Trump or Nixon or, you know, it depends on, you know, when you're born and when you live.
Yeah.
But it's always the same thing. It's always like trying to elevate something that is essentially spontaneous and populist into mm-hmm. something that is elite and artistic. And that's really not where popular music should be.
Right now.
You want that. You know, go listen to opera.
Exactly. Yeah. And no one wants to do that, or at least those people.
No, they don't know how.
They don't know how.
They wouldn't know how to listen to opera.
I admit that I'm one of them. You know, the one aside, Marie Claire is going after Taylor Swift because she hasn't expressed a political opinion about Trump or anything. They are demanding her. They're demanding her to do that. I just find that hilarious. Like, who are you? How important are you, Marie Claire? What? I mean, the politics in mass market magazines are hilarious. They just had to close down the print version of Teen Vogue after they deliberately decided to go progressive, and now they had to fire 80 employees because nobody wants their politics in a teenage fashion magazine. At least not me. Hey, I want to ask you, because you know what? The thing about Dennis Boyles is that he was the king of service journalism. He could tell you how to live your life. Always gave great tips. I haven't even talked about your history, but you know, I think you discovered P.J. O'Rourke, didn't you?
Well, no. I mean, P.J. and I went to we went to school together at Hopkins at the same time, and actually, he didn't need discovering. He was running an underground newspaper. This is in the 60s, mm-hmm. called Harry.
Yeah.
And I was going to run another underground newspaper, but with my eye on my resume, I called mine the Chesapeake Weekly Review of Literature and the Arts.
Nice.
And I said to him, I said, O'Rourke, you're never going to get any place, having said you edited an underground rag called Harry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so shows how smart I was. But we did some great pieces together. He did a piece for me, I think it's in one of his books, where he had to take the train to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked him to review it as environmental theater. And he did, it was great. It was a great review of the train ride, you know, with all the extras and all the props and all that stuff. It was wonderful.
That's excellent. I always go to you to ask, you know, I send stuff to you to look at, to read. And there's always one problem that I have, and I keep asking you about this. I have written almost every kind of thing. I've actually even written poetry, which Christmas poetry that I put in Men's Health. But I've done eight books or seven books. I've written essays. I've written magazine articles, reporting, service journalism, you name it, satire. I can't write fiction. And I go back and forth with you about I've written screenplays that were obviously fiction, but they were, to me, they were terrible because I don't know how to develop. I don't have any confidence in fiction. And how can I have confidence in the other stuff and not in fiction? And what are your suggestions?
I mean, we've talked about this before. I think the real problem with fiction, and I mean, I have trouble with it too, is that to write fiction, you really have to assume a lot. You have to assume, you know, the character that you're writing about, you have to assume that he knows right from wrong and she does the best thing possible at the best possible moment and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's rude. I think it's
assuming a lot of the viewer or the reader to waste their time with this flight of fancy. Is that
right?
Yeah. So I'm not the only one.
Yeah, I can't imagine it. I can't imagine anybody saying I can't read fiction. I have a hard enough time reading it, let alone writing it. But I mean, I can't imagine anybody saying, "Oh, look, here's a book that starts off by saying it's all made up."
Yeah,
you know, I'm going to invest my afternoon in this.
Yes,
it's crazy.
Do you know what's
If you want to play around with fantasy, just listen to political speeches. I mean, because fiction's nowhere.
Yeah, no, it's true. You know, I get in this fight—not a fight, but all Dana Perino reads is fiction, and I don't understand it. I go I'm trying to think of what. I remember the classics. That's about as far as I can go, you know. If I think about an afternoon to read something, I want to read where I come away and go, I just filled my brain with stuff. I want to feel that way, like I had a good meal. And fiction makes me think like I'm eating airy cotton candy with no meaning at all. So maybe that's why I'll never write anything. I want to write a movie, though, but maybe I should just do a documentary.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think that you know, history is actually better than fiction for me. I just finished reading something today about a place north of where I am here in France, about 50 miles away, where there's a big castle. And when when the armies from Paris were marching through here and hanging the priests and all that kind of stuff, they took 400 old people, women and children, and pushed them in a huge well. And then started dumping tree logs on top of it.
Jesus.
I mean, try putting that in fiction.
Yeah.
I mean, it's astonishing. Astonishing that these things actually happen in real life, let alone the figment of somebody's imagination.
You know, that is I've said this in a different way when everybody talks about how much they love The Walking Dead. Everybody watches The Walking Dead but me. And I always say because we have it. It's called ISIS. Like, I don't watch horror movies anymore. I've stopped. I think after 9/11, I stopped watching horror movies because I just was like, I can't imagine anything worse than what went on the World Trade Center. So you can't shock me. You can't make me sick to my stomach. Flesh eating zombies. We have that, you know.
Right.
By the way, before I forget, you were I remember this. It just dawned on me, and it was like 1992, maybe it was 92. It was okay. When did communism fall? Was that 92? Bush was president, right? Was it 91?
I think 91. Wasn't it 89 or 91? The fall of the Berlin Wall, I guess, is the day. I think 1991 or 92 was when the Communist Party collapsed in Russia, right?
Right. I think it was because I feel like George Bush was still president, but I don't think Clinton was president. That's why I think I was so surprised that Bush lost. But I remember talking to you at a bar, and I go, wow. I mean, I never thought I would see this in my lifetime, that this would happen. And like, the world's going to be great now. And you said, I don't know, Greg. There's this – you started talking about something called Islamic fundamentalism, and I got so bored. I remember you telling me about this, and you were going like, Greg, I just – it's all over the place, and I'm like, I'm really. You said you were really worried. You were really worried, and I'm like going, I don't know. I was basically, don't bore me with this. I remember that I was bored. Like I wanted you to say yes, Greg. Everything's going to be great, and you didn't. You just. Do you remember that at all?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I remember the expression on your face when you get really bored with things. Because I've actually had to sit and try to explain ideas to you. And suddenly your eyes go glossy and you make this very polite smile and these noises are coming out of your mouth that don't mean anything, but they're sort of, you know, sort of calming and stuff. And then you're kind of, you're like, you're walking and you're asleep.
Yes.
And you're like, wait, you know, stop. There's a ledge.
That's so true. I forgot about that, I would get into like a weird state when I would just kind of float away. And you were used to notice this in meetings.
Right. Yeah. There's great. Well, how could you not? I mean, you were actually levitating. You were like, there he goes. He's in his own outer body experience. Oh, 1991 is when communism fell in Russia.
Yeah.
So, yeah, Yeah, and I think that all these things are like, once you sort of predict the future, you start talking about, oh, wait till you hear about Salafism or something
like that.
I think, you know, I mean, people do get really bored. They're bored until the story actually shows up at the front door with a gun in its hand.
Yes.
Then they're interested.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, it's, you know, ISIS was the JV team, you know.
Right, remember that?
Yeah. I wish.
Talk about watching the wrong game.
No, exactly. Exactly. So I got to let you go because there's a guy coming in at 4 o'clock. Oh, by the way, I shouldn't say that because the people listening to this will then realize this was taped earlier. But is there anything people can look forward to seeing you, or where I should direct them to your latest book or anything you want to plug?
I've been writing book reviews for the Claremont Review of Books. Yeah, if you want to go there, I'll send you a link if you want to pass it around.
Yeah, I could put a link on the I'll put a link in the on this page where we have the podcast.
Okay, I've been trying to review books that are actually like ahead of the news. So that by the time you read the book, it's actually what you're reading in the newspaper.
That's pretty good. You know, you were always ahead. You're ahead of the internet boom too. See, it's not good to be ahead of things, Dennis. You're way ahead of ahead of Islamic fundamentalism. You're also. I remember you had a website like in '93 or something, right? Or '94?
Yeah, before, a long time ago.
You had a website before there was the web.
It was just slide projections on my bedroom wall, but it was really exciting.
It was. No, but you had. I'm not actually joking. You had a website, and when nobody really knew what websites were, and you were so ahead of the game. It sucks to be ahead of things, Dennis.
Yeah, I know. The trouble is now I'm ahead of my own life. This is sad. That's sad.
If you haven't read any of Dennis's books, you can go on Amazon, put his name in. Dennis, it's D-E-N-I-S, not D-E-N-N-I-S. D-E-N-I-S. Boys. And you were on the staff of National Lampoon, weren't you, briefly? I forgot about that.
Yeah, I worked for Rock and Roll magazines back in the mid-70s, and then moved from there to the New York Times Magazine. And from there, it like within a space of months, went to work for National Lampoon. Mm-hmm. So you can see where my trajectory is.
Yes. But if you go on Amazon, yes, I've read The Modern Man's Guide to Life is good. And I read, oh, God, what was the African, not African Lives, Maneater's Motel.
Yeah, African Lives.
Yeah,
Motel, right.
Yeah, I read also Maneater Motel. I read that. That was fun.
Oh, good.
Yeah, see? I remember. Dennis, always a pleasure.
Nice talking to you too, Greg.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Talk to you soon. Bye.